This event is for the release of an important MPI report, Still an Hourglass, Immigrant Workers and Middle-Skilled Jobs. MPI President Dimitrios Papadimitriou provides introductory comments, and then Michael Fix and Margie McHugh, who are co-directors of MPI's National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy, discuss the report's findings and implications for higher education and other work-preparing institutions. Anthony Carnevali, director of the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce, provides comments on the report, as does Assistant Education Secretary for Post-Secondary Education, Eduardo Martin Ochoa. We turn first to MPI President Dimitri Papadimitriou.
Good morning, everyone. I am Dimitri Papadimitriou from the Migration Policy Institute, and I'd like to welcome you to this foreign location. I'd like to sort of set the context, as it were, the stage a little bit for what is to transpire in the next hour and a half with this extremely wonderful and expert panel. Whether we appreciate it or not, and frankly, whether we like it or not, we are one of only a handful of countries that have been, are, and most likely will continue to grow and prosper through immigration. And you may want to put a question mark next to prosper, but, you know, that's up to you. All of these countries happen to be English-speaking countries. And I haven't said that these are the only countries that experience large-scale immigration. Now, an awful lot of countries, relative newcomers to the game, countries that have entered the immigration game with a great deal of passion, if you will, and have grown to have foreign-born populations that are sometimes rivaling and even in larger exceeding ours. I want to stay with the countries that are the traditional countries of immigration, and the preeminent such country, of course, being the United States. Now, when I said growing, many people are thinking in terms of demographics. But I want us to go beyond demographics, because immigration not only grows the country in terms of population, but it also changes and grows socially, culturally, and, of course, economically. In the last decade or so, and that's why I put the question mark, and I made it optional, there are a lot of people who feel that they need to question the contribution of immigrants to our economic success, and there are perhaps more people who are worried about the societal effect of large-scale immigration. And in some ways, but only in some ways, the concern appears to be well-founded. We have lost our way in managing our borders with any efficiency or certainly success. And that's, of course, at the heart of our food fight about illegal immigration. And we have systematically made legal immigrants ineligible for basic federal social protections. We are the only advanced industrial democracy that has done so. And that's a particular concern of mine. We have allowed a 45-year-old system, unchanged since 1965, to define how we're going to grow economically through migration. And that is unforgivable in an era where competitiveness of both firms and by extension of societies, of economies, is such a big issue, such a big variable that determines how we are going to do in the future. Today's report does not answer all of these questions. The Migration Policy Institute releases reports across all of the issues that I mentioned. Today's report is exploring something that we really haven't been curious enough and hadn't thought about how to do it methodologically. Namely, how do immigrants do in the economy? We all have this mental image of a barbell or an hourglass or what have you, you know, something that has been popularized by article after article, newspapers, media, reports, where most immigrants are concentrated on the one side, low education, relatively poor outcomes in terms of you know, economic outcomes for themselves and their families, and then another bunch of immigrants at the other end doing relatively well and extremely well, and then very few immigrants in the middle. And today's report looks at how immigrants are really faring in the mid-skill occupations in four sectors: construction, IT, hospitality, and health. Four sectors in which they are overrepresented. And even in that regard, it doesn't provide all of the answers. It provides an initial answer. And for some, perhaps, a bit of a surprising answer. Now, I'm not going to give the answer away. We'll let the authors of the report do that. I don't want to spoil the party. But it appears that there may be more success in mid-skill family-sustaining wages than many people may have thought. A word about what the report doesn't do, and then I'll introduce the panel and go and sit down. The report doesn't address issues of competition with natives. Not that we don't care about it. We care about it a great deal. We have a labor markets working group that does that. We have issued several reports. We will issue several more in the next 6 months, and we'll publish a book in the next 12 months. Nor does it address illegal immigration issues, although clearly some of the people who are the subject of today's report are probably here illegally, and we'll all understand that. And of course, it doesn't provide a final word to any of these issues. Nonetheless, this is the first report in a project that will last probably about a year longer, and that will issue many more reports that will refine and go deeper into the issues that the report deals with today. So our panel, particularly distinguished today, and we're grateful for their presence here. Tony Carnevale, he's sort of a dean on issues of education and workforce. He's at Georgetown University, where he heads the Center on Education and the Workforce. He has served three presidents, going back to Mr. Reagan, on issues of education and workforce. He has been a senior official in a union, and it is a great pleasure to see you here again, Tony. We meet all too infrequently. Second person is Eduardo Martin Ochoa, sorry, who, I apologize, who is the Assistant Secretary in the Department of Education for post-secondary education. He's a second economist together with Tony on the panel. He has been a professor of economics and an administrator, a senior administrator at a variety of universities, most recently at Pomona University in California, where he was the provost and vice president for academic affairs. Very good. Roughly right. And, of course, Michael Fix and Randy Capps, who are the authors of this report. You know Michael. He's the senior vice president at the Migration Policy Institute, also the director of studies, also the co-founder with Margie Mathieu to my left of the National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy. I know that you know these folks. So I'll step down, and I will now let the regular process take place. I understand that the order in which people will appear is Michael Fix first, followed by Margie Mathieu, followed by Tony, and by Dr. Shaw. Thank you very much.
What I want to do this morning is to kind of put the ball in play. I want to walk you through some of the results of a study that we are releasing this morning, Still in Hourglass, Immigrant Workers in Middle-Skill Jobs. That it's a report that Randy and I and Serena Lynn have written. And what I'll do is I'll put the ball in play, and then after the presentations from the panel, we will collectively respond to any questions you might have about the report. There is an abridged version of the report on your chair, what we sort of affectionately refer to as Baby Gates at the moment. Now, the report and the analysis in it lie at the intersection of our own work at MPI on labor markets and on immigrant integration. And the work in the report and the report itself has been funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And they are, as Margie will discuss, part of a larger Gates-funded research project where we're looking into the effectiveness of post-secondary training, post-secondary education and workforce training for first and second generation immigrants with a special focus on the population that's 16 to 26 years, 6 years old. And one of the first, and I have to tell you, consuming projects of that larger project has been to try to map patterns of immigrant incorporation in the U.S. labor market, and we focus specifically on four sectors, on construction, on health, on information technology, and on hospitality. These are four sectors that the reason we selected them is because we believe that they have long job ladders, and they are four sectors in which immigrants have historically been highly concentrated. Now, we've tried to answer with the research basically five animating questions. First animating question is, when you think about these long job ladders, our going in question was, are immigrants churning at the bottom of these job ladders, or are they, in fact, climbing these ladders? Second, and relatedly, are they moving not just into high-skill jobs and low-skill jobs, but are they also moving into middle-skill jobs, the middle-skill jobs that offer a leg up for non-college-bound people and that pay, according to the lexicon of the Gates Foundation, what is referred to as a family-sustaining wage? Third question we ask is, how much variation do we actually see across these four sectors, and with what implications for investing in career pathways? Fourth question that we asked is, what are the characteristics? What are the education, the language proficiency, tenure in the United States, characteristics of immigrants who do and who do not get, if you will, these good middle-skill jobs in the economy? And then the final question, you know, the elephant in our analytic room, is what impact has the recession had on immigrant employment patterns across the sectors and across the economy as a whole? I thought that instead of going through our methodology for the study, I would just tell you a little bit about some of the defining characteristics of the work. That is to say, some of the things that we're kind of proud about that we think are at least slightly innovative in the work. First, of course, is the fact that we've taken the sectoral approach, and we've examined immigrant employment across these four sectors that grew rapidly before the recession. Together, these four sectors account for 40% of immigrant employment in the U.S. economy in 2006. Now, why take a sectoral approach? We've done so for three reasons. First, it generally maps pretty well against the career pathways that are now organizing post-secondary education and workforce training, so it's useful. Second, we did it to get a sense of variation across the sectors, which, as it turned out, was really much wider than the three non-economists who set forth to write the paper, much wider than we had perhaps expected. And finally, we took this sectoral approach in part because this lens of looking at the immigrant labor force really hasn't been taken much in the U.S. literature, which has mostly looked at the immigrant workforce as a whole and has not parsed it by sector. Now, a second defining characteristic of the work has been not just to look at the occupations that immigrants and natives hold, but it's to be going beyond that. And what we did was we very laboriously and very meticulously classified these occupations into the skills that they require, and we grouped them, we boiled them down into three different skill levels: high skill, essentially requiring a BA or more; middle skill, generally requiring more than a high school degree but less than a college degree, or requiring substantial work experience or on-the-job training; and finally, low-skill jobs, requiring only moderate or short-term job training. A third, if you will, defining feature of the work and of the analysis is our preoccupation with the degree to which immigrant and native workers earn what the Economic Policy Institute refers to as family-sustaining wages. And these are wages basically that are thought to be sufficient to largely ensure a family's intergenerational escape from poverty. And finally, I think our concerns with immigrant integration made us deeply interested in the characteristics of the immigrant workers who are and who are not earning family-sustaining wages, their educations, their English skills, their tenure in the United States, their age, and importantly, in this post-recessionary period, their gender. And as you can see here, we disaggregated the results for 1990 through 2006. For 2006, the peak of the boom, and for 2008 and for 2009, as the recession unfolds within the economy. So with that, let me slip over here again to get into our findings. So our first obvious finding is that between 1990 and 2006, the U.S. labor market was an absolute miracle of immigrant incorporation. As you can see from these graphs, the shares of immigrant workers in the total U.S. economy and for each of the four study sectors soared between 1990 and 2006, with all four growing faster than the economy as a whole, and with immigrants far outpacing native growth rates. All told, the four sectors gained a total of 4.3 million workers during this period. And between 2000 and 2006 alone, immigrants accounted for half of the net new growth in workers in the U.S. economy. But then, of course, along comes the recession. And here we have two fairly straightforward sectoral stories. One is that the sectors perform very differently through the business cycle. Health continues to grow. And while the fastest growing sector before the recession, construction, as you can see, dives. And the second story that we see here is that just as immigrants' growth outpaced natives before the recession, they lag it across all four sectors after the recession. Now, I think everybody knows this stuff, but I think it's also useful to see it as a picture. Dimitri sort of gave the punchline away. What was new when we looked at these data and when we arrayed these data, and what we didn't expect to find, was that immigrants are concentrated to a degree to which we hadn't expected in middle-skill jobs. Now, the lectures that I always used to give before I did this project, I said that the immigrant labor force is shaped like an hourglass, concentrated at the top, concentrated at the bottom, but narrow in the middle. The corollary of this is what I would say, which was equally wrong, is that the native labor force is shaped like a diamond, narrow at the top, narrow at the bottom, and wide in the middle. But the data on this table, especially the data that's in red, suggest that these images may no longer hold. If I could cut to the chase, when we look at the immigrant labor force in 2006, what we see is more middle than high-skill workers, 24 versus 20%. We see that the share of immigrant middle-skill workers grew by 50% between 2000 and 2006. What you see, interestingly, if you look at the last column in 2006, is that the overall shape of the native and the immigrant workforce looks largely similar when we look at the distribution of high, middle, and low-skill workers, so that the hourglass and diamond stuff I used to talk about, really, it doesn't hold much anymore. And then finally, if you look at the third line down, what we find is a much less encouraging story, and that's that over half, 56%, of immigrant workers remained in low-skill jobs and the number of immigrants entering those jobs was growing almost as fast as middle-skill work between 2000 and 2006. But this is, of course, why we are worrying so much about the success of work-preparing institutions and these first- and second-generation immigrants. If we look at the skill distribution of workers by sector, and here what we're looking at is the light green segments of these bars, we see that there are substantial shares of immigrants in middle-skill jobs in three of the four sectors, in health, construction, and in hospitality. If you look at IT, what you see is that IT is really a high-skill sector. Almost 82% of workers in IT are high-skilled. And our preoccupation with the skill level of these jobs is obviously tied to the wages that they offer. And as the pale yellow bars on the right here indicate, if you look at immigrant workers in middle-skill jobs, they were twice as likely, 60 versus 28%, to earn family-sustaining wages as immigrants in low-skill jobs. That is to say, a middle-skill job is a good proxy for making a good wage. Don't look at this just yet. Look away for a moment. I'll get to this, but this is the preamble to it. I think that one of our more interesting findings when we were doing this study is that the immigrants who were holding these middle-skill jobs were, in some instances, in particular construction, if you will, over-leveraging their education skills, and in other instances, such as the health sector, they were, if you will, under-leveraging their education skills. That is to say that when we looked at construction, we found that many of the immigrants that were holding middle-skill jobs had very low levels of education, didn't speak English, were recently arrived in the United States, and were comparatively young. And although we couldn't and didn't disaggregate by legal status, it's reasonable to suspect that at least some of them might have been unauthorized. So one effect of the recession and of the evaporation of these construction jobs is that this pathway for lesser educated immigrants into what was certainly the middle class has seemed to be narrow, or at least disappear. At least in the short run. And construction's collapse also underscores the fact that following the recession, pathways to the middle class are likely to put even more of a premium on graduating from high school, on speaking English well, and on obtaining post-secondary credentials than has probably been true in the past. In health, we found something a little bit different. In health, we found, as we found in other research, which is out there, which is a report called Uneven Progress, that many of the immigrants who are holding these middle-skill jobs, these good middle-skill jobs, paying a family-sustaining wages, were more educated than their native counterparts. So while they might have been earning a family-sustaining wage, they may still have been underutilized in the U.S. economy. Now you can look at the slide here. And another way to put this, and this is in this slide, is that immigrants are less represented, especially in low-skill jobs, than their education credentials might predict. If you look at this chart, what you see is that immigrants were four times more likely than natives to not have a high school degree, 28% versus 7%. But they were only somewhat more likely to be in low-skill jobs, 56 to 46%. So if our going in question was whether immigrants were successfully integrating in these sectors with long job ladders, part of the answer will, of course, turn on the wages they receive. And one way to look at this chart is to conclude that immigrants did quite well. Indeed, the shares of immigrants earning family-sustaining wages exceeded natives in three of the four sectors that we looked at. They exceeded natives in hospitality, in IT, and in health. So, let me summarize. We have these mixed, nuanced, somewhat surprising, fairly straightforward findings. First, broad penetration of immigrants across sectors. Penetration not just in high and low, but in middle-skill jobs. We see that still most immigrant workers, 56% of immigrant workers, were in low-skill jobs. Immigrants in middle-skill jobs were much more likely to earn family-sustaining wages, good wages, than were immigrants in low-skill jobs. In three of our four sectors, immigrants in middle-skill jobs were as likely or more likely than natives to earn family-sustaining wages as their native native counterparts. And what that suggests to me is that complicates arguments that immigrants are driving down wages, at least in those sectors. Overall, immigrants fared worse than natives across these sectors following the recession. We found that construction pathways to the middle-skilled jobs have narrowed for less educated, limited English proficient, recent immigrants, and for immigrant youth. And as a result, we find, or suppose, or surmise, that language and post-secondary credentials have become even more critical to good jobs that pay family-sustaining wages than they were before the recession. Let me just go briefly touch on some policy implications and then turn the floor over to our panelists. First, from the kind of immigrant integration perspective that Margie McHugh and I have been worrying about, these findings, which clearly underscore the value of moving from lower to middle-skill jobs, run headlong into the multiple challenges facing the post-secondary education and workforce training systems that Margie and Tony and Dr. Ochoa will discuss. But I think, and I won't dwell on those, but what I think is that the implications go beyond immigration policy to raise some questions, go beyond immigrant integration policy to raise some important questions about immigration policy per se. And here what strikes me as I array these results in front of me and you, is since there are comparatively few employment visas that are issued for middle-skill workers, I think we can assume that many of these workers are arriving under family visas. And so I wonder, in turn, if these trends suggest that the often maligned family-based U.S. admission system may be getting some things more right than is often given credit for. It also suggests to me that the admission of middle-skill workers could well be a logical focus of the kind of standing commission on labor markets that my colleagues Doris Meisner and Dmitry Papadimitriou have so persuasively recommended to policymakers, and that will, in turn, and in the end, examine issues of wage and labor market competition, of labor surpluses and labor shortages. And with that, I'll turn the floor over to my colleague, Margie McHugh.
So first of all, you'll see that threaded throughout the report is the issue of English proficiency and its impact on wages and advancement. And certainly the report points out a pretty high penalty for limited English proficiency status. I think we found generally that in the report that about 63% of those who were English proficient earned a family-sustaining wage, while only 30% of those who were LEP did so. So in terms of the integration impacts of the report, those will be the ones that I'll focus a little bit more on, since the report comes out of our National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy. Obviously, this points to the question that's been very much on people's minds for many years now: the need to expand adult ESL instruction in the U.S. But then also, when you look at the report, I think it raises the questions of for whom and for what purpose. Because generally when we speak about the expansion of ESL classes, it's often in the context of, for example, citizenship, helping immigrants get through the citizenship process. But obviously if we take this labor market frame, I think it adds a lot more breadth and depth. Another issue that it points to, I think, pretty directly is if we're going to talk about the expansion of adult ESL instruction, we need to take into account that right now that system doesn't have a particularly good record in terms of student progress. Only about 35% of students who are enrolled in adult ESL classes progress to the next level after a course of study. And obviously that gets to these issues of quality of instruction, which, you know, there certainly is an issue of quality, intensity, and the like. But there's also the issue that these are adult students and that a lot of them are not not able very often to persist in classes because of family and work and transportation and other issues. So it's a fairly complex area that also then points to the issue of more cost-effective instruction, which might be more distance or technology-based, all issues which the adult ed system has been looking at for quite some time. There's also, in our minds, the issue of the uneven quality and capacity of these systems, both across and within states. We get in trouble with a lot of our colleagues who are in the traditional immigrant-receiving states when we keep talking about capacity issues for the new destination states, the states that only recently have become destinations for immigrants over the last 10 to 15 years or so. But many of the large immigrant-receiving states say, hey, we have plenty of counties and localities within our states that have not ever had high rates of immigration. So we have, they also feel that they have those sort of new destination capacity issues, even in large states such as California and New York. Another major issue that we're very focused on, both with the report and in other areas of our work at MPI, is the need to improve the integration of adult basic education, ESL, and workforce programs, something I know that Dr. Ochoa and the Department of Ed are very much focused on right now. There's a big concern that so much of the instruction in ESL is pooled at the lower levels and that there's not a lot of advancement up the rungs to the higher levels of ESL. Also, that there's not much integrated instruction, so that for a very long time now, we've been expecting adult students to spend quite a long time in either basic education or ESL classes and only then move over into workforce instruction or workforce training, and that the silos that characterize the instruction is really a major barrier for immigrants, for adult learners who are trying to make their way towards the sorts of credentials that they need to move up the job ladder. Then the findings of the report also point to additional challenges, both for the low and the highly educated. Remember that even though we think sort of the good news story of the report is how many immigrants are in middle skill jobs, we also see that over 56% of immigrant workers are in low skill jobs. And for many of them, they face the double challenge of both low literacy in their native language as well as their LEP status. And so that's a particular challenge for people who are working in adult education and community college systems, trying to help those folks along a longer pathway towards getting the English and the credentials that they need. But then also, and as Michael said, this is a very big focus for us at the center, there's the issue of the highly educated who are pretty obviously having difficulties in transferring the education credentials that they've obtained overseas, the education, work training, work experience credentials, and having them actually transfer into the U.S. job market. And that's a fairly complex set of issues that we're looking at a lot more closely. One of them is simply the actual recognition by employers. Education institutions do a better job of recognizing, figuring out how to recognize some of the education qualifications. Employers very often simply discount a lot of the education and training that immigrants acquire overseas. But then even if one were to simply try to fill gaps, very often when we offer programs in say, the healthcare fields and the like, we really don't have a way to just give people the one or two additional areas of knowledge or skill that they need. We want them to pretty much take the entire degree program all over again. We also have we're pretty weak on some of the higher English learning needs that are related to the language in a profession, the professional language needs that one might need in, for example, healthcare. So, you know, this is for us a very big part of the context of these numbers that you see here. The other thing I wanted to do just to set the stage for the conversation that will follow is talk about very briefly about what we see as some of these significant elements in the environment that we're in right now in terms of what it might look like to take some of the learnings from this report and the larger project that it's nested in and try and move forward on some of the issues that it points to. So first, I think, in terms of the in terms of how we think about, you know, whether we can move people further up on these ladders within the different occupations, we think it's a pretty positive environment that in the adult ed world and in the community college world, you see a lot more of a focus now on transitions to work credentials and moving up out of adult basic education and ESL classes over into higher education and work credentials. So in a sense, we're sort of moving with the trend of change in those fields, which hopefully will mean that these issues aren't there's a little bit more momentum behind them. We also see that there are many successful models out there, both for working with limited English proficient individuals, those who are LEP and also have low literacy, and even for those people who are highly literate or highly skilled. The problem is one that you all hear a lot about, which is that these are often islands of excellence and not programs or initiatives that we have figured out how to bring to scale. One of the real challenges we face in terms of the environment is simply that you're reading about this all the time in the papers, that there's a lot more competition for classroom space, for program seats in these types of adult education and workforce programs as a result of the recession. And also, because of the recession's impact on state budgets, there's a huge amount of competition for funding and pretty severe budget cuts in many of the states. One of the states that I'll just mention briefly here is California, which has lost a terrific amount of its capacity in adult education over the past 2 years. Because not because of a direct budget cut, but because the money that was available for adult education was made available then to the K-12 system. And so a lot of money has, because of the budget cuts in K-12 and the pressure of NCLB, a lot of that money that had been supporting adult English and ESL. And so we see it as a particular tragedy that the system's taken such a big hit now as a result of the budget issues out in California. Then another positive or opportunity that we see on the accreditation, more and more of hospitals and healthcare providers, is going to drive demand for new workers with language skills. We think that will actually pass this week, but if the DREAM Act were to pass, the implementation of that law would again be wind in this, would be moving in the direction that many of the reforms of the adult ed system are already moving in terms of better targeted instruction and instruction that moves people from sort of the non-credit basic ed ESL side of the house over into this side of the house that's credit-bearing and gives more degrees and credentials. We're trying to engage very much the business community in this because we know that businesses obviously are increasingly involved as a result of the Workforce Investment Act and some of the decisions and the planning that's being done in states around these issues. And also there's such huge providers already of training that we're very eager to see since so many are hopeful about the ability of business, for example, to help out on limited English proficient workers. We're very eager to see where there might be some success with that so that, you know, we're not just looking at the education and work preparing institutions, although obviously they're at the heart of what we're looking at. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Carnevale. Welcome him to the podium.
Hi. Thank you for inviting me. I must say that I was also somewhat surprised at what I saw in the data in this report. And shouldn't have been. I think we see laid out here with great rigor is something that in the end is really relatively simple, and that is labor markets impact people who want to work. And immigration in America has always been about work. And immigration, it is no accident that the outlines of the immigrant population, at least in terms of their working hours, which has always been a strong connection. But now, in this more modern economy, with respect to their education and skill profiles, conform with education and skill profiles in the economy on the whole. I also think that this particular frame is useful from a policy perspective because it moves us past immigration as a social question and moves it towards a perspective on immigration as an economic question, which in the end it largely is. It is not surprising also in the sense that what we're seeing in the American context is a fundamental change that has happened over a relatively short period of time, in economic history anyway, and that is since the 80-81 recession in the United States, the value of post-secondary education and training, college as it were, meaning certificates, certifications, employer-based training, and a whole variety of different kinds of formal and informal kinds of learning that occur in the United States that in the end are our workforce development system, that apparatus has become more and more important to us and more central in people's ability to integrate themselves into the broad American middle class. After the 80-81 recession, we saw a fall off in the United States in post-secondary participation, especially in our two-year and four-year institutions. That is, the rate of increase slowed down, if you can stay with that for a moment. And when the rate of increase slowed down, the wages began to go up. They did so very rapidly between 82 and 83 and so on until the wage premium exceeded 70%, rising from around 38% in the 1970s. This has declined. It is as much about people moving up as it is about people moving down. And what really drives access to the middle class and allocates people in the bottom three deciles, the middle four, and the top three are their access to post-secondary education and training, and the alignment of those education and training experiences with occupations. That is, over time, the occupational structure of the United States has changed dramatically. We've moved away from manufacturing and natural resources in a fairly dramatic way, the old middle skill jobs. And we've moved towards a service economy whose core degree really is the bachelor's degree, but where there are large numbers of middle skill jobs. It is one of the errors that is made in the analysis of the American economy, the consistent argument that one hears that it is an hourglass-shaped economy or a barbell-shaped economy. In fact, most of the data, that is the one study that tends to support that, is a study in which somebody looked at the distribution of jobs in 1983, used the same job categories, and looked again in 2007. What they essentially found was a lot of the jobs that were there in 1983 were not there in 2007. The jobs that went away were in manufacturing and natural resources. They did not count the jobs that moved into the middle-level skill set that paid decent wages that came from the service economy, healthcare, professional and business services, information, occupations, and the like, which is where the growth in middle-skill jobs has been. And so we still have a robust top end in the American economy underneath this recession and a robust middle skills economy with occupations more and more concentrated in service middle skill jobs and a fairly robust bottom, that is lower wage, lower skill jobs that require high school and high school dropouts, because as the economy moves upstream and demands more and more post-secondary education and training, the numbers of people with post-secondary education and training continue to increase, and what is amply supplied is always valued a little bit less than what is scarce. And we can see, can see in the 1990s, that we shored up the wages at the bottom because there are fewer and fewer people there. The fewer people you have to fill low-skill, low-wage jobs, the more likely their wages are not to decline, which is really what we've achieved. That is, we put a bottom, finally, on the economy, it looks like. When we come out of this recession, all of this, I suspect, will become, will continue and become much stronger. It is all driven by the same mechanism, and in the end, it is mechanism. It is largely technology-driven. What tends to happen, to oversimplify it a bit, is that our old friend the computer, hooked up to other technologies in all its disguises, tends to automate anything that is repetitive, any task, any routine, any function in a job tends to get automated throughout the occupational range. It leaves behind those functions and creates new ones, really, to take advantage of the power of the technology. It leaves behind and creates new job functions that require that are not repetitive. And because the functions are not repetitive, they then require higher skill levels, one and different skill levels, skills that we used to think were reserved for management and senior technical workers, like problem solving, critical thinking, and in a service economy, which is what we're becoming very rapidly, communications with others. And so there is a dynamic underneath the economy, an engine, that if it continues, and there's no reason to believe it won't, the technology is available, globalization ensures that we will use it, we have no choice, and when we come out of this recession, a lot of the jobs that were high school or less, as in the past two recessions, incidentally, are not coming back. And so more and more, what we'll find in the American system is that post-secondary education and training is required. This story isn't helped by the fact that the government gets the data wrong. We do not project or count or connect occupations and education requirements in the American system, contrary to popular belief. That is, the Bureau of Labor Statistics does not project education demand, neither does the Education Department. And in the case of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, there is a single table that is produced in their projections. It was used to be Table 5, now I think it's Table 8, in which essentially the analysts assign education requirements. They're not projected, they're not analyzed. Nobody looks inside the occupations to see what the trends are. Nobody runs a regression analysis to see where the wages are going. As a result of that, to give you one example, and I'll get off this, it's a hobby horse of mine. In 2008, a year for which we have the actual numbers of people in the American economy who had different levels of post-secondary education and training, if you look at the 1998 projections from the Bureau of Labor Statistics out to 2008, they missed by 22 million post-secondary degrees and awards in a labor force that could not have been much more than, at that time, 148 million workers. So there is a huge discrepancy in our data in terms of our ability to actually find out what jobs require. So one of the things I would advise the authors is not to use that Bureau of Labor Statistics data. It's simply wrong. If you look more closely, one of the things I think you'll find consistent with the findings in this study is that every occupation has a distribution of educational attainment and awards, and that distribution always favors those with higher education and training levels. And I think one of the things we're seeing here is that skilled immigrants occupy somewhere along the upper end of that range in many, many occupations. Whether they're paid the same as others with the same educational attainment in the occupation, I don't know. I have a suspicion they may not be, but I really just don't know. In the end, I think it's important when we think in terms of policy to recognize this single fact and this frame, not just for immigration policy, but I would argue for education policy as well. And that is, more and more in the United States, with no other system to turn to, we've made post-secondary education and training our workforce development system. We stopped funding Department of Labor training programs a long time ago. The peak year for funding Department of Labor training programs was 1979, the last budget presented by Jimmy Carter. If we run those numbers forward to the current time, that is, correct them for inflation, essentially, we would be spending $25 billion a year on the Workforce Investment Act. We are spending $3.7 billion a year currently in the president's budget. So we essentially abandoned that system and abandoned it in favor of the education system. Principally, at least in terms of the visibility of the different parts of that system, principally the community colleges, which is where virtually all of the increase in education, post-secondary enrollments, have occurred in the United States. To this administration's credit, it has focused there. The focus on getting an additional year of post-secondary education, which confuses educators because that's not a degree, to get the focus on certificates, even on industry-based certifications, which are of some importance, I think, with respect to immigrants who are in STEM fields, in the information industry, in healthcare, and so on. We're a very industry-based certification-driven system, uniquely in the world in that regard. We have no apprenticeship apparatus. We have no work and learning apparatus, as much as the phrase is in education and training since 81, 82. We've tripled the number of people with post-secondary education and training, and at the same time more than doubled the wage premium for those people over high school graduates and high school dropouts. In 1970, if you were a high school graduate or a high school dropout in America, you had a 60% chance of being in the middle four deciles of the income distribution, a rough measure of the middle class, the middle 40% of the earnings distribution. Nowadays, if you have a high school degree or you are a high school dropout, notwithstanding recession, your chances of being in that middle four deciles, the middle class, it drops to around 30%. So the share of people with post-secondary education and training in those middle-class deciles has grown appreciably to the extent that nowadays, if you've got an AA or a certificate or a certification of some kind, chances are pretty good that you will have stayed in the middle class, although there is a fairly substantial stream, about a third of the population in these middle-skill categories who have either gone, about half of them have fallen out of the middle class, that has fallen down into the bottom three deciles, and about half of them have moved up from the middle four deciles to the top three deciles. That is the rock in the stream in the American system where people divide middle class or not seems to be in these middle skill jobs and the middle skill education and training that comes with them. If you have a bachelor's degree or better in the United States compared to the 70s, the odds are very high that you stay in the middle class. It's virtual certainty. And what is most striking about people with bachelor's degree or graduate education is that a very substantial share have left the middle class and moved upward into the top three income deciles. So when you look at middle class decline in America, and middle class has declined, it is as much about people moving up as it is about people moving down. And what really drives access to the middle class and allocates people in the bottom three deciles, the middle four, and the top three are their access to post-secondary education and training, and the alignment of those education and training experiences with occupations. That is, over time, the occupational structure of the United States has changed dramatically. We've moved away from manufacturing and natural resources in a fairly dramatic way, the old middle skill jobs, and we've moved towards a service economy whose core degree really is the bachelor's degree, but where there are large numbers of middle skill jobs. It is one of the errors that is made in the analysis of the American economy, the consistent argument that one hears that it is an hourglass-shaped economy or a barbell-shaped economy. In fact, most of the data, that is the one study that tends to support that, is a study in which somebody looked at the distribution of jobs in 1983, used the same job categories, and looked again in 2007. What they essentially found was a lot of the jobs that were there in 1983 were not there in 2007. The jobs that went away were in manufacturing and natural resources. They did not count the jobs that moved into the middle level skill set that paid decent wages that came from the service economy, healthcare, professional and business services, information, occupations, and the like, which is where the growth in middle skill jobs has been. And so we still have a robust top end in the American economy underneath this recession, and a robust middle skills economy with occupations more and more concentrated in service middle skill jobs, and a fairly robust bottom, that is, lower wage, lower skill jobs that require high school and high school dropouts. Because as the economy moves upstream and demands more and more post-secondary education and training, the numbers of people with post-secondary education and training continue to increase, and what is amply supplied is always valued a little bit less than what is scarce. And we can see, can see in the 1990s, that we shored up the wages at the bottom because there are fewer and fewer people there. The fewer people you have to fill low-skill, low-wage jobs, the more likely their wages are not to decline, which is really what we've achieved. That is, we put a bottom, finally, on the economy, it looks like. When we come out of this recession, all of this, I suspect, will become, will continue and become much stronger. It is all driven by the same mechanism, and in the end, it is mechanism. It is largely technology-driven. What tends to happen, to oversimplify it a bit, is that our old friend the computer, hooked up to other technologies in all its disguises, tends to automate anything that is repetitive, any task, any routine, any function in a job tends to get automated throughout the occupational range. It leaves behind those functions and creates new ones, really, to take advantage of the power of the technology. It leaves behind and creates new job functions that require, they're not repetitive. And because the functions are not repetitive, they then require higher skill levels, one and different skill levels, skills that we used to think were reserved for management and senior technical workers like problem solving, for critical thinking, and in a service economy, which is what we're becoming very rapidly, communications with others. And so there is a dynamic underneath the economy, an engine, that if it continues, and there's no reason to believe it won't, the technology is available, globalization ensures that we will use it, we have no choice, and when we come out of this recession, a lot of the jobs that were high school or less, as in the past two recessions, incidentally, are not coming back. And so more and more, what we'll find in the American system is that post-secondary education and training is required. This story isn't helped by the fact that the government gets the data wrong. We do not project or count or connect occupations and education requirements in the American system, contrary to popular belief. That is, the Bureau of Labor Statistics does not project education demand, neither does the Education Department. And in the case of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, there is a single table that is produced in their projections. It was used to be Table 5, now I think it's Table 8, in which essentially the analysts assign education requirements. They're not projected. They're not analyzed. Nobody looks inside the occupations to see what the trends are. Nobody runs a regression analysis to see where the wages are going. As a result of that, to give you one example, and I'll get off this, it's a hobby horse of mine. In 2008, a year for which we have the actual numbers of people in the American economy who had different levels of post-secondary education and training, if you look at the 1998 projections from the Bureau of Labor Statistics out to 2008, they missed by 22 million post-secondary degrees and awards in a labor force that could not have been much more than, at that time, 148 million workers. So there is a huge discrepancy in our data in terms of our ability to actually find out what jobs require. So one of the things I would advise the authors is not to use that Bureau of Labor Statistics data. It's simply wrong. If you look more closely, one of the things I think you'll find consistent with the findings in this study is that every occupation has a distribution of educational attainment and awards, and that distribution always favors those with higher education and training levels. And I think one of the things we're seeing here is that skilled immigrants occupy somewhere along the upper end of that range in many, many occupations, whether they're paid the same as others with the same educational attainment in the occupation, I don't know. I have a suspicion they may not be, but I really just don't know. In the end, I think it's important when we think in terms of policy to recognize this single fact and this frame, not just for immigration policy, but I would argue for education policy as well. And that is more and more in the United States, with no other system to turn to, we've made post-secondary education and training our workforce development system. We stopped funding Department of Labor training programs a long time ago. The peak year for funding Department of Labor training programs was 1979, the last Carter, the last budget presented by Jimmy Carter. If we run those numbers forward to the current time, that is, correct them for inflation, essentially, we would be spending $25 billion a year on the Workforce Investment Act. We are spending $3.7 billion a year currently in the president's budget. So we essentially abandoned that system and abandoned it in favor of the education system. Principally, at least in terms of the visibility of the different parts of that system, principally the community colleges, which is where virtually all of the increase in education, post-secondary enrollments, have occurred in the United States. To this administration's credit, it has focused there. The focus on getting an additional year of post-secondary education, which confuses educators because that's not a degree, to get the focus on certificates, even on industry-based certifications, which are of some importance, I think, with respect to immigrants who are in STEM fields, in the information industry, in healthcare, and so on. We're a very industry-based certification-driven system, uniquely in the world in that regard. We have no apprenticeship apparatus. We have no work and learning apparatus, as much as the phrase is intriguing and exciting. We simply don't have it here. Employers train. Their training system is bigger than the post-secondary education and training system. It runs about formal and informal. It's about $500 billion a year. But they're not educators, and they don't intend to be. They want the education system to give them people who are ready for work-based learning, focused on technology change and particular requirements in occupations and industries. And so my bias about this is that, truth be told, if we want effective education and training for immigrants and other people, it ought to be more driven by labor market metrics, which is to say, if you're an institution that claims to provide occupational education or training for somebody, the measure of your success ought to be wage records. The measure of your success ought to be whether or not the people you educate and train get employed. We have that data. We've been collecting wage records in the United States since the late 1930s when we passed the Unemployment Insurance Act. We can do this in 11 or 12 states now quite easily. In fact, they are doing it in places like Florida, such that if you're in a program in the American system in those states, we can find out pretty readily whether you got work and how much money you made, that is, whether the education and training affected your labor market prospects, which in a system where workforce development, especially the occupationally based version of it, post-secondary institutions is primary, that's the outcome system we need. Secondly, I would argue that if you look at post-secondary education in America, it's occupational, vocational, and professional already. Virtually all graduate degrees are professional degrees, even the ones where there are no jobs. If you take a PhD in Middle Eastern literature, surely you know that there aren't many jobs for that in the United States. But it is a degree in a very focused area where you intend to work, one supposes. Virtually all graduate degrees are occupational in focus. And then in the BA realm in the United States, 15% of degrees, actually only about 4% of degrees in America now, are liberal arts degrees. If you add up all the other degrees where one does not see an occupation, religion, the arts, humanities, and so on and so forth, you end up with about 15% that don't have specific occupational attachments. And then if you look at the two-year system, apart from the academic AAs, which don't tend to bring any high earnings returns, essentially, because they only bring earnings returns if the academic AA results in a BA. That is, if you transfer and graduate, usually in an occupationally focused program. All the occupational AAs are the ASs, the sciences, and the AAS is the much more focused vocational preparation. All of those degrees purport to provide you with the skill, a set of skills that will move you into a particular occupation. I think it is noteworthy that when push came to shove and we felt we needed to do something about proprietary schools, their ineffectiveness in moving people to employment, in the end what the government reached for immediately without much debate with the wage records, that is, the proposed ruling in the United States at the moment from the administration is that if you take a program from a proprietary school or a certificate in a community college and the earnings that you accrue as measured by the Social Security Administration as proposed, the earnings that you accrue are much too low to support the debt that you've incurred, then that program ought not to be given federal funding. I don't know why that's not true for all the other occupational and professional programs in the system. It is a good discipline. It is one in hard times that will help us save money. One last point, and that is one point that has been made by Ms. McHugh, and I agree with it entirely, is that there is a separation between English language learning, adult education, adult basic education, so on and so on and so on, and job-related learning. One of the more obvious things that's beginning to happen in many states is that we're integrating basic skills preparation. I don't know why we can't integrate English language learning into occupational programs. Someone who wants to get a job and goes to a school to learn a particular occupation What you should be doing them with them is teaching them the English they need to perform in that occupation. That is commonly done in Europe, and the basic skills they need to perform in that occupation. So I think the integration of these programs, a tough question, how do you roll adult basic education into occupational preparation? The politics of that are heinous. But the logic is, I think, unassailable. So in the end, I think this frame is a very fresh and healthy one for immigration policy. It takes us away from all the old American issues about otherness and so on and so forth. The truth is we're an immigrant nation that doesn't like immigrants very much, and that's who we've always been. I suspect we'll always be that way. It is consistently true. Claudia Golden tells me that if you go back to the early 1800s, you could pretty much predict a vote on taxes depending on how many Irish people there were in the jurisdiction in the colonies, and the more Irish, the less likely people voted for increased taxes. We're still dealing with that same, the price of diversity in this system that comes with all the benefits that it brings. Thanks.
This was a very interesting report, and as a 14-year-old immigrant myself, I can certainly relate to the experience that it talks about, although I was fortunate in that my parents were university graduates, and for me there was never a question about going to college, and they even had the foresight to send me to a British schools while still in Argentina, so I was really very lucky. But the situation in California really prepares me to be not surprised at all by this report. My last institution, I taught at two other California State University campuses, Cal State Los Angeles, which I like to think of as the Ellis Island of higher education, and Cal Poly Pomona. Cal State LA, as my of its student body, is Latino, and many of those are first-generation immigrants. Cal Poly Pomona has a substantial Asian population, again, many of whom are first-generation immigrants. And in between those two campuses, straddled by those two campuses, is San Valley, about a 30-mile stretch of suburbia between Pomona and downtown L.A., which is teeming with immigrant households and businesses that are quietly moving up the ladder and fulfilling their American dreams. So I've seen firsthand the fact that the traditional immigrant upward path in American society remains strong, continues to work. The other thing I wanted to mention, my staff prepared me to mention that we do have a number of programs already in the department that deal with the issues that this report identifies, and we're well aware of the need to strengthen them and expand their work. In fact, there is an initiative in the government, a cross-departmental initiative to focus attention on what we are doing to integrate immigrants into the U.S. economy and society, and that group is asking. We had to submit a report in my office to them about what programs do we have that actually promote that, and we found that really we don't have any that specifically target immigrants. But when we look at the impact that our programs have, almost everything we do has a positive impact on that. Again, I've seen the effect of, for example, programs like TRIO programs and Upward Bound, Gear Up. These are programs that promote do outreach to students to from socioeconomically disadvantaged groups to go to college and stay in college, and a large percentage of those students are in fact immigrants. So I think that you know, this is a very very important work, and I also wanted to make a couple of observations about some of the issues that Dr. Carnevale has mentioned. I do have to say that while it's true that most bachelors have an occupational bent, most of those, even required by their national accrediting groups, have a substantial component of general education, or what the American Association of Colleges and Universities calls liberal education. And that is a distinctive characteristic of American higher education, in contrast to European, that I think is a strength for us. A number of us in academia have been watching with interest the so-called Bologna process that tries to really very explicitly articulate what the accomplishments and levels of education are for different degrees, and link them to different disciplines and occupations. But I think that in our case, as was mentioned, our employers in this sort of information society are looking for the kinds of skills that typically come with a liberal education. And we know that our graduates are going to be changing careers multiple times in their lifetime, so it's and knowledge becomes obsolete very quickly. So the most important thing we can do with our college graduates is to prepare them to be lifelong learners and to adapt and solve problems. And so it's that methodology that is really the most fungible skill that they can acquire. So I do think that there are some real strengths in the traditional liberal arts based education in the United States that we should not easily dismiss. Okay, we've gone on for quite a bit, so maybe I'll stop at this point.
Yeah. Very helpful, very helpful. Thank you so much, and thanks to the panel. Randy, do you have anything you want to throw in, or shall we just open it up for questions? If there are any questions in the audience for any of the panelists except me. Yes. Letitia.
Findings. Oh, sorry. How some of these findings might map onto the current initiatives under the Obama administration, and particularly this talk about community colleges and even the debate right now over private higher education and the meaning of that, whether that should grow, how funding should be allotted, especially with financial aid, and how that might map onto the findings today.
Yes. Well, I did notice in some of Dr. Carnevale's remarks, they sort of touched or connected to the current brouhaha over gainful employment, which are rules that are being developed by our department. And I think that Secretary Duncan has been clear that the for-profit sector in higher education It has a role to play, and it's going to be a needed element in the race to achieve the president's 2020 goal for the U.S. In terms of education. But there have been concerns about students that may be becoming heavily indebted and then are not able to find jobs that can provide incomes sufficient to be able to handle that debt. So that is an issue. It's an issue that, but it is, I mean, it has opened the door to a broader question of the broader question of accountability, and is this in fact the way that we're going to be judging all of higher education, or at least more of it than just the sectors that are currently provided for in statute. And I think it is an interesting question, one that I'm not prepared to settle right here at this point. But certainly, I think that it has not gone unnoticed, and the legislature may have something to say about it too in the future.
Can I provoke any other questions out of the audience? Well, you know what? I have sworn to Dr. Ochoa that he would be able to leave by 10:30. I think what we'll do is we'll just conclude the panel. Thank you very much. If you have questions, please come up and talk to us now. And there is coffee and lots of reports in the lobby. And thank you again so much for coming.
For more information on MPI research, please visit www.migrationpolicy.org/LMI.